Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming to this session. I hope you're having a good conference so far. Look, I'm absolutely delighted to be able to introduce Kim to speak to us on this vital topic about trust, something I know that we've all been grappling with. Kim, to introduce her, we've known each other for a number of years, is passionate about making a difference in everything she does. For the last 10-plus years, Kim has worked in a number of key players in the financial services industry, Deloitte, and she told me not to say this, but she won the Young Leaders Prize in 2012, a great achievement, BT, and now Pacific Life Re, and she's currently transitioning to her new role as Head of Product at BT, where she can continue to make a difference in everything she does. Like you, Kim is an actuary, and the colour in her life comes from dancing, traveling and sunrise yoga overlooking freshwater beach. That sounds lovely. Well, please join me in, but before you do that, sorry, can I just remind you of three things? Please fill your feedback form, because that's vital. When you have questions later on, please speak into the mic, because this is being recorded. And finally, there are three prizes, and the closing is this afternoon, so get your entries in for that. And with that, would you please warmly welcome Kim to speak to us on this topic.
There are not many degrees that prepare you for a role in the life insurance industry, but actuaries are uniquely positioned as experts that can have a massive influence on the industry. Traditionally, we've taken statutory roles. As Odette Excel said yesterday, we've done a great job at managing risk and protecting the companies that we work for. We look at managing risk appetite and making sure that our companies meet a hurdle rate of return on capital. But today, I want us to take our policeman hat off and put on the customer hat. I want us to move from thinking about shareholder profit to thinking about member benefit, as we did when most life insurers were owned by mutuals. I want to stop analysing the past and start looking at defining the future. Move from analysing the expected cost of doing something to the potential benefit. I started my career at Deloitte, as Young said, and in a consulting role, it was fantastic to get my start as a grad working on some high-profile M&As and working on valuations, getting up to speed with access, but I had zero concept of the customer. I saw a life insurer as a projection of cash flows. It was only once I moved into my pricing role at BT did I actually start to get some concept of the customer. And it intrigued me so much, I moved into a product role where I got to do customer testing and understand even more about the end customer. But I think that no matter what role we play in a life insurer, we all have a role to play, whether we do experience analysis, build business cases, or do pricing. We're all trusted advisors to the business, and we need to use our approval power for good. I want to challenge us all to think differently and to think about the customer. When we see increasing claims coming through, what is the right response? Do we put up prices? Do we tighten terms and conditions? Or do we withdraw reinsurance capacity? I think that there might be an alternative approach to these solutions. When we see increasing claims, do we understand the underlying drivers behind that? And can we use that to better understand what the future will look like? I think we need to look beyond our field. As was discussed yesterday, we need to work in multidisciplinary teams to better understand this. We need to look outside our comfort zone, look overseas and to other industries. And this will give us more well-informed assumptions so that we can drive positive outcomes for both customers and companies. Trust. Life insurers have a great privilege in our society. We provide critical benefits, and we should all be very proud that we're there for customers in their time of need. But if the community lacks trust in our essential services, this can threaten the financial stability of the industry. We have complex processes and sometimes poor customer outcomes. As we heard from Jeff Summerhayes yesterday, APRA really sees that strong link between consumer trust and sustainability. Consumer trust is essential to the long-term long-term financial health of the life insurance system and goes hand in hand with strong capital and solvency ratios. I think actuaries have always had a keen interest in industry sustainability, but I think we need to look at the recent issues and think maybe the best solution instead of looking at how to manage profitability is to look at how we can build consumer trust so that we can continue to provide stable, affordably priced products and improve the health and financial well-being of those protected. Again, this stat was used yesterday, but I think it's profound. 78% of people believe that life insurance is important, but only 42% believe that the insurer will be there at their time of need. This is a massive trust gap. And I don't want to just talk at a holistic level, but bring it down to the actual customers that are affected by some of the mistrust and give you a real example of a close friend of mine who claimed a few years ago. He got sick and stopped work at around Christmas time, but it wasn't until the following year at tax time did he see on his group tax certificate a deduction for insurance. He then claimed, and once on claim, the insurer sent him to the GP monthly to get ongoing claims forms. This was a paper-pushing exercise and just wore down his energy and did not contribute to a greater health come in any way. After being on claim for quite a while, they decided to review his claim and sent him to an independent medical expert. The independent medical expert, he was very excited to see because he thought maybe they would have an update on his prognosis or a change to his treatment plan. Instead, the doctor just sent a letter to his insurer saying they should decline the claim. They did. He escalated it through their internal dispute resolution processes and then to the superannuations complaints tribunal. The SCT said it wasn't their jurisdiction, passed him over to FOS, the Financial Ombudsman Service, who in turn passed him back to the SCT. He then got legal support, which his claim was then reinstated. But this is not a great customer outcome. I want to live in a world where people are aware that they have cover and they know what they're covered for. When they're sent to see a doctor, it's to improve their health outcomes and that they don't need any legal support to make it through a simple claims process. And if they do have any issues with the process, there's a really simple dispute resolution process. And fantastically, there has already been some progress towards this when 2 weeks ago within the budget, the Ramsay review recommendations were accepted by the government and they are now going to have one complaint, the Australian Financial Complaints Authority, which will mean that the buck will stop with them, which is good. So this is the burning platform that I think we have to look at. But unfortunately, trust and value are not correlated. As you'll see from the Edelman Trust Barometer, Edelman is a consultant that came up with this barometer to try to look at the trust in different industries. All the way to the far end, we see the most trusted is the iPhone, and that's despite only returning 35 cents in the dollar to each customer. Unfortunately, at the low end of the scale is financial services, which may not surprise you. But, for example, group insurance pays back 80 cents in the dollar in terms of claims. In 2016, life insurers paid out $8.7 billion to Australians, and 90% of claims were paid in the first instance. At the same time, the RBA Financial Stability Review that just came out highlighted that profits for life insurers dropped in 2016, with return on equity the lowest it's been since the GFC. We are providing more value than ever, but still haven't built consumer trust. So how do we do it? I think there are three ways: through regulation, products and pricing, and customer engagement. Starting with regulation, I'm going to talk about existing, new, and future regulation coming through. We've had a lot of consumer protections enshrined in law for many years, and this covers insurers, trustees, and advisors. The Insurance Contracts Act has the utmost duty of good faith. Trustees are required to put duties of interests of beneficiaries ahead of others, and FOFA introduced into the Corporations Act advises requirements to meet customer best interests. Despite this, we've seen the Festival of Life Insurance, as ASIC Deputy Chairman Peter Kell calls it. We've been called devils, spying on our customers. Our products have been called worthless and junk. So there has been intense media scrutiny, but I don't think that we should just pass this off as a national pastime. It's not like bank bashing, Canberra slagging, or hating Delta Goodrum. It is something that we can actually change. I think the only thing worse than the lack of consumer trust is consumer apathy, the she'll be right attitude. But I'm happy to report the life insurance industry has not been apathetic, and we've had a positive response to this media scrutiny by introducing the Life Insurance Code of Practice. And we're going to go one step further and include super funds in this through the Insurance and Super Working Group. But at the moment, it's about to be implemented on the 1st of July, but at the moment it's just a bunch of words on a piece of paper. But there are some very important words in that document. Empathy, respect and compassion. It's all about how we turn those words into action. It's in the spirit of the application, and it's in all of our hands to apply this in an appropriate way. It's not just about looking at the compliance in terms of the disclosures of sales practices or the surveillance at claims handling time. It's really to think differently and be progressive with about how we meet the provisions and the requirements such as the timeframes to respond to claims and underwriting. The life insurance industry has been under strong scrutiny through the Parliamentary Joint Committee. Its report has been delayed till the 31st of October, and we can expect even more things coming off the back of that. As discussed earlier, Dr. Bill Munday raised that Beyond Blue had a submission around mental illness. APLs were also covered, and also the role of group insurance. Speaking of which, the Productivity Commission is looking at alternative default structures within super, and all of these things are going to shape the regulation in our industry. Some more reforms coming in shortly are the life insurance remuneration regulations. From 1st of January next year, upfront commissions are going to be dropped and clawbacks are going to be extended to 2 years. The year after, advisor standards are coming in around education. And in 2020, the Code of Ethics for Advisors is coming in. All of this aims to improve the quality of advice and align the interests of customers and advisors. Fantastically, and actuary has been at the centre of helping drive this with the Trowbridge report. And I think that we need to think about actuaries who are involved in these sorts of driving regulation and think about how we can get involved as well. What's next for regulation? Well, I think legacy rationalisation is a really important topic and something that is holding us back, as much of the media scrutiny is not around the current on-sale products but are around the old products that are difficult to update. Although, unfortunately, we heard from APRA yesterday that it doesn't look like that's going to be high on the priority of legislators anytime soon. One of my bugbears is stamp duty. The operational risk and costs of implementing stamp duty is ridiculous. It needs to either be aligned or eliminated altogether to improve underinsurance. And finally, we need to remove barriers to rehab payments, which I'll come back to. Now let's look at products and pricing. We need to think about what customer needs we're trying to fulfil. How are other markets doing this? If a disruptor was coming into the market, how would they meet these clients' needs? I think it's interesting to look at Brits. They have the same problem. They don't want to be caught short if they're suffering an injury or illness. And I think Poms know their onions, which apparently means they're knowledgeable. They do have a few slight differences in the structure of their products to meet their customer needs, and it's interesting to explore how they've come up with something different to meet very similar needs. One of the aspects is the long-term lock-in nature of their products. They have much higher upfront commissions, about double year one premium, and even longer clawback at up to 4 years. They also generally have guaranteed level-term products that lock customers in. But given the push a few years ago for bank exit fees to be removed and to encourage mortgage customers to be able to find the mortgage that's right for them, I think there's less room for a set-and-forget approach. The new generation of consumers want living, breathing insurance provisions that can respond to their needs. So should we be starting to think about churn in a different way, from a customer perspective, and assisting customers get to the insurance that best meets their needs at that time? Comparison sites is something that has also taken off in the UK, which has meant that there's consumers can directly compare products, which has increased competition and pricing, but also driven insurers towards more differentiation, personalisation and engagement with InsurTech, which I'll come back to. I think the second big thing that we can learn from POMS is the clarity that they've driven through introducing minimum standard definitions last century. They have not only done this through having descriptive headings, which take away the medical jargon and mean that customers can get a better sense for what they're covered, such as cancer excluding less advanced cases or heart attack of specified severity. But I think the biggest thing we can learn from them is how they work together with various community stakeholder groups. They have engaged the equivalent of the Heart Foundation and the Cancer Council in coming up with their critical illness definitions. They, having this backing and this robust discussion has actually surprised the Association of British Insurers. These community organisations are not pushing to cover every single heart attack. They do look at the impact on the customer's life and set a reasonable limit for the minimum standards. This means if any customer is unhappy, their complaint can be directed rather than at the insurer specifically, but at the Association of British Insurers, who can then call on these community supports to show how we've gone through a robust process to come up with these definitions that are also updated every 3 years. Finally, I think it's really interesting that POMS tend not to have standalone TPD, but rather have this as a benefit within critical illness. I question the role of TPD, total and permanent. This goes completely against recovery. It causes many claims management issues with a dichotomous outcome of either nothing paid or a windfall. There's an incentive not to return to work, which is not in the best interests of customers, as it does not recognise the health benefits of good work. Sun Super did a study to look at TPD claimants and their return to work. 36% returned to work or were actively seeking work, and many other insurers and funds have done similar studies with similar outcomes. This custom issue with TPD then is compounded by the profitability issues that we've seen in group TPD with a blowout in claims. But what has been the industry response? We've been fiddling with definitions, tightening from unlikely to unable. I'm not sure I understand the difference, lawyers understand the difference, let alone a customer on the street. We've put up prices. Is there something else we could look at? Is there some way we could be more innovative and help these customers rather than just pay them and let them go? Could we actually help them return to work? A lot of superannuation funds have actually gone beyond the MySuper default requirements of offering death and TPD, and they've added income protection as well. Vic Super and Australian Super both have income protection, but the Commonwealth Super Corporation with their PSSA product has gone one step further and they've pushed out their TPD payment to 24 months. This allows them to intervene early and help with rehab through the IP payments over the first 2 years, and it pushes out the assessment of TPD. Catholic Super has done something similar with paying only 60% of TPD after 3 months and the remaining after 3 years. They also recognise that there are some very severe forms of TPD, such as loss of limbs or those that can't perform activities of daily living, and these are generally still paid day one. Sun Super has taken another approach again and cut down its TPD payments into 6 equal instalments. These super funds are making sure that their customers aren't just supported at the time of disability, but they're supported in returning to work and helping them save for their retirement. Now I want to have a look at the innovation in the sharing economy. I think customers are often reticent to look at professional advisors or big organisations for support. They want to look at people like them. Just like on your energy bill, where they often show how much similar households use in terms of energy, people get comforted by the actions of other people like them. I just want to go through four examples from around the world of different ways that the sharing economy has worked for insurance. Bought by Many is in the US, and it uses group buying power to get discounted rates on insurance. Friendsurance is from Germany, and it pays a claim-free bonus where a group of friends don't claim. InSport is from the UK, and it uses social media to connect family and friends and provide insurance to those pools. It means that you might want to check if there are any boy racers in your Facebook friendship group and maybe defriend them. My favourite, though, is Peer Cover from New Zealand. Personally, whenever I see a crowdfunding campaign that is looking to raise money based on someone's family who's been impacted by injury, illness, or a death in the family, I get very disappointed that insurance hasn't played that critical role. Peer Cover build on this concept and do donation matching for crowdfunding campaigns. It costs $20 to become a member of the Peer Cover Crisis Club, and if you do end up going through a crowdfunding campaign, it will match donations, material donations raised based on the number of members in the Crisis Club. Now on to pricing. There are just two pricing areas I wanted to cover, and one of them is cross-subsidies. I think it's hard to get the balance right between the nature of insurance, which is around pooling, versus making sure that we're not letting anti-selective lives take advantage of our cover. We could learn from health insurance, which has community rating, or from general insurance, which has very granular pricing, such as how UWI do their pricing. But I just want us to think about some of the inequity that cross-subsidies can create. Women retire with less than half the super of men and then need that super to work longer for them over their life expectancy. But quite often women pay the same as men for their insurance premiums when actually they're at a lower risk. Is that equitable and fair? Next is the discontinuities that we've seen in pricing over recent times. And really I just want to call out that we need to work with multiple industry stakeholders to really understand the underlying drivers of some of these trends. We've done some work with Maurice Blackburn, a legal group who back in 2013 ran some campaigns on TV to entice people who may be eligible for a TPD claim to call them. They saw a spike in inquiries, and this subsequently resulted in a spike in TPD claim notifications. Subsequent campaigns have not had the same outcome. This means that there were some people who were unaware and their awareness was raised that they were eligible for cover, and these have been paid and flowed through. And hence we've seen the increases in group TPD rates started to come back down. I think the more we can understand the drivers behind these, the more we can avoid some pricing discontinuities. So finally, I just want to talk about customer engagement. I think that we need to give customers the option to engage with us anytime, anywhere, anyhow. They've come to expect real-time 24/7 access. Access through online, app, phone, paper, face-to-face. South Africa's Discovery now has more e-claims than paper-based. They offer app, portal, or scan and email. But I think going one step further is Lemonade, who are a pay-as-you-go insurer in the US who really offer personalised cover and different ways of interacting with them. Let's have a look. Oh. I thought it was interesting there. I thought I'd call out that they give some money to charity, and that really goes to the social responsibility that Jeff Summerhayes was also talking about yesterday. Lemonade actually have the world record for the world's fastest claim. That was 3 seconds. So it actually took Brendan 6 minutes to submit his claim. It was for a $979 Parker that was stolen. And what AI Jim did, which was based on Jim, who was the real claims assessor, the claim bot referenced his policy, ran 18 anti-fraud algorithms, and approved and transferred in 3 seconds. The real Jim was on a train at the time, wouldn't have even looked at the claim that came in. I understand that life is a bit more complex, but another example is New York Life in India that pay 60% of their claims through straight-through processing. It is much more like health insurance, but they do manage to achieve this through targeted requirement gathering, which is based on the risk profile rather than a one-size-fits-all approach. Life insurance is more complex, and we need to be careful with that. We need to make sure customers are aware of their cover and educated on the claims process. We need to be in regular contact with them to give updates, say via SMS, and give them options on how to engage with us. But actuaries don't pay claims. I think we need to make sure we have think about the human element to building trust. It's not just about having smoother processes, although that will help, but as Helen Troop touched on yesterday, understanding real-life examples and that complexity and what else that they're going through is really important. Having a biopsychosocial view of the world, as was discussed in the plenary this morning, is important. Here's another 2-minute video.
So what is empathy, and why is it very different than sympathy? Empathy fuels connection. Sympathy drives disconnection. Empathy, it's very interesting. Teresa Wiseman is a nursing scholar who studied professions, very diverse professions, where empathy is relevant, and came up with 4 qualities of empathy. Perspective taking, the ability to take the perspective of another person or recognize their perspective as their truth. Staying out of judgment, not easy when you enjoy it as much as most of us do. Recognizing emotion in other people and then communicating that. Empathy is feeling with people. And to me, I always think of empathy as this kind of sacred space when someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we look and we say, hey, I'm down. I know what it's like down here. And you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, uh-huh. No, you want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. And we do it all the time. Because you know what? Someone just shared something with us that's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So, I had a miscarriage. Oh, at least you know you can get pregnant. I think my marriage is falling apart. At least you have a marriage. John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
So I think connection is really important. And as David said yesterday in his talk on consumer trust, the more that we can engage with customers, the more trust we will build. We need to engage to inspire better outcomes. We can engage in a timely, relevant way through digital means. Through using data to have personalised event-driven communications, we can really connect with our customers. Events such as if they've ceased work or their accounts become inactive. The Insurance and Super Working Group has released a member comms and engagement discussion paper, and it covers a number of great things which really look to other industries that we can learn from. One of them is the home and contents industry, which in 2011 brought in the concept of key fact statements after the Queensland floods. These statements use consistent and simple language. They cover the costs, benefits and risks of the cover so that the customer can understand, compare and act. They also introduce standard naming conventions, which I really think we need, given we use concepts such as new events cover, limited cover, pre-existing cover. I have actually dealt with super funds before that wanted to remove their pre-existing condition cover to introduce new events cover. It's the exact same thing. Just they wanted to call it something different because they thought it would be more palatable to the customer, which isn't fantastic. I think we need to move away from just having the full disclosure to also having simple disclosures which are graphically signposted with clear language. The final example of us going to where the customer already is that I want to show here is a financial services industry. A bank, Westpac, has looked at teaming up with fintech startup PayKey, and they have introduced an icon into their messaging app which really goes to the social media apps where the customers are rather than requiring them to jump out into the Westpac app. And this allows them to pay their family and friends right there in their messaging app. A few years ago, I spoke at a similar actuarial conference and I talked about the concept of putting a black box in your car and using that to help determine what your motor insurance premium should be. Telematics. I'm pleased to say since then it's really evolved and improved and it's really gone to where the customer needs it. Instead of spying on them by putting a black box in their car, we put it on an app that they can easily access. What this means is that they are now being triggered to play a game, which is fun, but also their competitive streak is triggered because they get a score and can compare it to their friends. So this is a great tool for preventative approaches. Home and contents has also have had similar preventative measures, such as Zurich teaming up with Cocoon to introduce home security devices which are the size of a tennis ball. These detect movement using low frequency sounds. Then they sound an alarm on your phone, send you a 30-second video, and you then have the opportunity to call the police if it's an issue. Life insurers have done some similar preventative measures in the health and wellness space. This not only encourages healthier lives to come into the system and existing lives to become healthier, it also changes the conversation around customer engagement. It improves sales and retention. Accenture found that 56% of customers want personalised advice on reducing the risk of loss and injury. We can really add value to customers in this way, similarly to how best doctors can help find a second opinion on the best treatment measures. This slide is all about using behavioural economics to have some quick wins at little cost. This case study is about a North American health insurer who used to have nurses call serious long-term illness patients. And they really managed to shift the customer perception of the conversation by changing the sequence of pleasure and pain. So they got the bad experiences over early, and what ended up happening as the outcome of this is customer satisfaction went through the roof and they were also more motivated to change their behaviour. And that assessors were also happier at the end too. And I think behavioural economics is something we can apply to all ends of the value chain from underwriting through to claims. Finally, we can also look at providing value-add services as they are looking to in Asia, which help people access treatments. In Asia, they're often only available in regional hubs like Singapore and Bangkok. So third-party administrators are being engaged to help find the right treatment, book accommodation and flights to get there. So coming back to what I'm asking you all to do, I really think not only do we need to think differently, but act differently. I think we all need to embrace regulation, but also help shape regulation. So a few years ago, I drafted BT's response to the Financial Systems Inquiry. I also flew down to Treasury to just give them education on how life insurance worked. I think that these are just tiny little things that I'm sure lots of you have also been involved with. And I don't think everyone can be John Trowbridge and have a review named after them, but there are FSC working groups or the insurance and super working groups that people can get involved with, or the LIW MPC. I think that we need to challenge the business to better meet the needs of customers and show them examples where they can learn from other industries and countries. If you are asked to review a PDS to approve it, do you just look at it and go, yes, my pricing assumptions are the same as what's allowed for in the PDS? That is good, but better is to look at, does this build consumer trust? So I know that whenever I had to sign off on a PDS, it was always marked up in red ink, and that was had very little to do with whether it met my pricing assumptions. And finally, I think we need to make sure we're giving credit for positive steps towards building health and well-being and better engaging with customers. Sometimes there is no data to say exactly what that step is going to do, but we need to make a punt, look at alternative data sources to build a business case and support this coming through. We need to take off the police officer hat and make sure we're firmly wearing the customer hat to build consumer trust and a more sustainable industry. But I think we should all start a discussion, and any questions? Yeah.
Well, firstly, would you... thank you, Kim, for that great talk and all the research you did. My goodness, that's fascinating. And really bringing the consumer into the room and how we can really engage with this issue. Can I remind you, if you've got a question, step up to the mic to because this is being recorded. Can I kick off with a question? So, we band it around as trust is a real issue, but is it a real issue, or is it really the media sort of beating us up? Because effectively, it's a $12 billion industry. Consumers are trusting us with $12 billion worth of their money. What's your take on that?
It is interesting, and I think, as I said before, in the most part, we pay 90% of claims first up. Most customers, I would say, have a positive experience through the claims process, and we are definitely delivering on our promise the majority of the time. I think we just need to have a very low tolerance for poor customer outcomes, and I think there are definitely some segments that need to be looked at. So you mentioned $12 billion is the premiums. Only a portion of that is people actually opting to give us premiums. The rest is mandated through MySuper, and they can opt out, but often there is that apathy which I spoke about, and they're not choosing to give us that premium. It's being taken from them, and often they have no awareness that they have the cover. And in my personal example of a close friend who went through it, it took him 6 months to realise that there was any cover. So there's a lack of awareness, and I think if people don't have any awareness of it, they can't have the trust there. I think that awareness piece is really important. I do think that there is a trust issue.
If it's okay, I'll make some comments rather than some questions. And Kim, fantastic presentation yet again. Thank you. That was great.
And I obviously don't have all the Merton. Answers, so you can probably answer some of the questions
won't try
as well.
Al Merton's my name. Do we have a trust issue? Absolutely. And anyone who walks out of the room thinking we don't, you're kidding yourselves. There's multiple dimensions of this. Kim's defined the personal issue that should affect all of us with our friends and family who don't understand what we're providing. That's the really basic level. At the top level, we should all be very worried about the statements that Jeff Summerhayes was making, and anyone who's been at the appointed actuary forums, operational risk reserves because of remediations, because of regulatory reviews, because of a lack of trust in the industries. The amount of money that our employers and our clients, in my case, are spending on these sorts of issues that come back to questions of behaviour and trust and conduct are enormous. which is all flowing into the pricing assumptions. So we absolutely have an issue. The other issue around it is a competitive one, that this is a basis on which companies compete. All financial services is all about providing product. You give me your money, you trust me to pay you back when you need it, either in terms of a deposit or superannuation or a claim on insurance. I don't care who I borrow from, but I do a little bit if they're going to play dirty, but I much more care who I give my money or place my trust in. So we have to live up to that. Now, I'm not an expert on it, but one of my colleagues has been doing a lot of research because our clients are saying to us, we think we got a problem because the media beats us up, the regulators beat us up, we don't feel good about what we're doing, and yet our customer satisfaction scores are pretty good. So customer sat and net promoter score, which are the traditional measures from a consumer perspective, aren't working. And so we've started trying to measure trust, and we don't ask people, do you trust your organisation? Because that doesn't work. So I can talk more about it separately, but we've created a way of looking at it. And some of the things that you were talking about, Kim, go to aspects of building trust. But I think one of the areas that actuaries can work is in areas of saying, what's the rational part of the product that helps to build trust? You know, how are we delivering to needs? But there are some of the engagement issues and how does the service actually work? So there are emotional and there are cognitive areas, there are institutional areas, and there are interpersonal areas. And that's the sort of framework that we're working on in terms of beginning to measure trust. Because again, if you go back to the competitive issue or being able to talk to regulators, it's not just about doing something a little better incrementally. It's also about showing how that's seen by customers as better, because it's no longer whether we think we're doing a good job, it's whether consumers think we're doing a good job. I'll leave it there, but happy to talk more about it.
Great. That's excellent. It would be good to have a good measure of consumer trust. I know we often use Roy Morgan, but it seemed that they would call random groups of people who had no idea whether they had insurance or not, so whether the trust measure was up one month and down the next month, it was very difficult to have it on your scorecard and influence.
Hi, I'm Martin Mulk here. Well done. Love the focus on the customers and all the practical examples. One recommendation and one question. For people in the room, if you're serious about understanding customers, one recommendation, really simple one, spend 1 or 2 hours every month in your call centre listening to calls from your customers. You will learn lots. Question, industry level, do you have a view on the role of the FSC, specific things the FSC can do to improve trust in the industry?
Well, I think the life insurance code of practice is a really good start. So the FSC obviously brought that in as an industry code. I think it is important that the industry bands together and builds against this trust issue, because it isn't just a one company issue, even though it's often easy to see that in the media and feel very lucky that you weren't the insurer that was mainly attacked. But it is a broader industry issue that I think the FSC can definitely tackle. But I think some of the real innovation is in how individual insurers then interpret that and apply it. So I think some of these more innovative ways of doing things are never going to be mandated at the industry level, and that customer engagement can really be enhanced that way rather than just at an FSC level.
Thank you, Kim. Fantastic presentation. I really enjoyed that. I've just got one suggestion for the insurance industry, a very humble suggestion, which is that the example that you brought about Lemonade, they're the only insurance company in the industry that have a B Corp certification. And B Corp are an organisation that says this company is certified because they are socially responsible. And I think that builds a lot of trust. So the humble suggestion is maybe that's something for all insurers to look at, to aspire to getting a B Corp certification.
Fantastic, thank you. They're both good, really good recommendations there. Yeah, definitely recommend being in call centres. That's great too.
Well, I think they've opened the door, so I think we must be time for our next session. Would you join me once again in thanking Kim for a terrific presentation?